From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. The men running for the highest office in the land are making their last appeals to the public.
What America needs now is someone who will finish the race before starting the victory lap. Someone who will fight to the end, and not for himself, but for his country. I have fought for you most of my life.
Yesterday, we brought you an in-depth look at Senator Barack Obama's political career. Today, we look at how Senator John McCain arrived at the pinnacle of his political life. We aired a version of this piece by NPR's Tony Cox during the Republican National Convention in September.
Thank you very much. It's wonderful to be back. And today, I announce my candidacy for President of the United States.
That was John McCain in New Hampshire on April 25th last year, officially announcing his bid for the White House. And later today, he'll take another step toward his goal when he accepts the Republican Party's presidential nomination. If elected in November, McCain will become the oldest president in U.S. history and the first commander-in-chief born outside the United States. So how did a former Navy captain and Vietnam prisoner of war get here? John McCain followed in the military footsteps of his father and grandfather, and in 1977 served as the Navy's liaison to the U.S. Senate, a role he describes as his official entry into politics. But retired General Counsel of the Army Delbert Spurlock says McCain moved into politics as a way to prove himself.
I think that he certainly didn't get all that he wanted out of a military career, all that it was expected. I mean, this was a guy who really could have had any position in the Navy that was possible for anyone to have, given his pedigree.
McCain was first elected to Congress in 1982, where he served two terms in the House before running for the U.S. Senate in 1986. In 2004, he was elected to his fourth term. Max Foltz was McCain's driver in 1992 and has maintained a relationship with him ever since.
He's a great person to work for. You feel like you have to do 110% all the time because, you know, that's what he gives. He's very energetic. He, you know, goes a mile a minute and he outruns his staff. You have to switch staff because he's so energized all the time and just the kind of person you'd want to have a beer with. Very down to earth, no sports. I would pick him up in the morning to take him to the airport, and it'd be 4 o'clock, and I'd always get up early and read the sports page to make sure I had something to talk to him about. And everything he brought up, he already knew about sports, and very fun to be around. And when you're around him, you feel like you're, you know, part of something bigger than yourself.
McCain's early days in the Senate were marred by an influence-peddling investigation involving Arizona banker Charles Keating, the head of the failed Lincoln Savings and Loan Association. McCain was one of the so-called Keating Five and was accused of accepting campaign contributions in exchange for interceding on Keating's behalf with federal regulators. McCain was eventually cleared of any wrongdoing, but was criticized for using poor judgment. Here's Frank Gilliam. He's Dean of Public Policy and Political Science at UCLA.
It was his first negative encounter, at least in a national sense, and that people have contributors that are less than savory and that they have been in and out of congressman's office asking for favors is, I don't think, a big surprise to the American public.
Now, in 1983, he was involved in another controversy having to do with the efforts to make Martin Luther King's birthday a national holiday. What happened?
Well, McCain really going with the party in the state was one of the Arizona, one of the few states to resist passing the King holiday into law. And McCain was certainly a strident voice in that opposition.
Reverend Oscar Tillman is president of the Phoenix branch of the NAACP in Arizona.
We knew he did what he was going to do, and that is that he probably didn't think it was worthwhile for us to celebrate a Martin Luther King Day, and he did not support it. And now for him to say that he was wrong, yes, I can say I'm wrong on a lot of things. Look how many people in jail and in prison say they were wrong, but you did it, and you did not help us. He could have stepped up to the plate and prevented possibly the state of Arizona from going through the eyesore fight that they had to do to get a Martin Luther King Day with the boycotts and everything, but Senator McCain, in his position, did nothing.
We can be slow as well to give greatness its due. A mistake I myself made long ago when I voted against a federal holiday in memory of Dr. King. I was wrong.
We all make mistakes. We all make mistakes.
I was wrong and eventually realized that in time to give full support for a state holiday in my home state of Arizona.
Now, he is described as a maverick and being partial to supporting bipartisan measures, but what have been his finest political moments?
Well, I think the standard there has been McCain-Feingold campaign finance reform. Russ Feingold, a well-known liberal senator from Wisconsin, they've authored a campaign finance reform bill that wanted to seek limits for campaign contributions. It was a bipartisan measure. It was certainly not a bill that was favored by mainstream Republicans who wanted much less restriction on the way that campaign contributions came in. And I think that's where he really gets his reputation as both a maverick from the party and a person who can work across party lines.
And McCain has support among African-American Republicans. Party activist Priscilla Smith says his policies benefit all.
What John McCain will do that will help African-Americans is his plans for innovation about energy, his plans to help lower gas prices, his plans to make the tax burden easier on people who own small businesses. By the way, the largest growing number of, to make it a little more flexible for that chief executive to work with, that does help African Americans and it does create more jobs.
How does he parlay that reputation from McCain-Feingold into running for the presidency in 2000?
Well, in 2000, again, the idea was to run as the anti-Washington candidate, much, by the way, as the election today is shaping up. That is, as a anti-Washington establishment politician, as a reformer, as somebody who was going to buck party lines. Then-candidate Bush was seen as a pretty straight, dyed-in-the-wool Republican. There was backlash against the Clinton-Gore administration, which Gore was carrying that baggage. So McCain tries to position himself in many senses as the third way.
Now, McCain won over Bush in the New Hampshire primary, and then Bush turned it around by the time they got to South Carolina. Is that where the bad blood between McCain and Bush first surfaces?
Well, primary campaigns are brutal contests, and McCain was seen as not being a party loyalist during that campaign. Bush is anything. If he's anything, he's a loyalist and values loyalty. And McCain was seen as being disloyal.
Here's John McCain speaking at the 2000 Shadow Convention in Philadelphia.
I am, of course, widely known for my discretion. And I thought losing myself in this crowd of like-minded shrinking violets would be a good way to keep a low profile until the Republican National Convention.
Do the risks that he presents, do they differ? Do the risks differ for people within the Republican Party versus the rest of the country? Or are the risks of a John McCain presidency the same?
Well, I think they are risks, but in different ways. They pose different kinds of risks to both segments of the population you describe. Within the party, the concern, of course, is that deep down he's a social liberal. And once in office, freed from having to worry about satisfying the conservative right, he'll hew back to what we've talked about a bit earlier, his more bipartisan and maverick days. To the rest of the country, the concern is that he has voted with the president's position about 90% of the time, and that he indeed tends to will ultimately end up continuing the policies of the Bush-Cheney administration. So there's lots of talk about Obama being a risk, fair enough, and I think there's lots of speculation about McCain being a risk as well.
John McCain has tried to recast himself as a bipartisan reformer while at the same time distancing himself from the unpopular policies of the Bush administration, especially the handling of the Iraq War. But Max Foss says John McCain would do well to follow his own advice.
He always said steady stream, and you know what he meant by that was you got to keep everything steady. There's high and lows in politics and in life, and you got to be in that steady stream in the middle. And you know you try to remember that, especially during campaigns, because you know, you could wake up and be, you know, ahead in the polls, and then a new poll comes out in the afternoon, you're down.
For NPR News, I'm Tony Cox.
Since the conventions, Senator McCain has had to deal with cheers and jeers for choosing Alaska Governor Sarah Palin as his running mate, plus the sudden nosedive of the economy. Here's News & Notes political contributor Ron Christie.
Senator McCain has a very short window of opportunity to make the case to the voters why he is the best individual to be the president of the United States. And I think it boils down in two areas. One, he's a proven commander as it deals with military and foreign affairs issues. And two, he's a proven leader in the United States Senate as it relates to financial issues, both of which will predominate whomever will be the next president of the United States in 2009. A very difficult financial environment, a very difficult time with America at war. Senator McCain is going to spend his remaining days going out, taking his case directly to the American people, and also reminding them of the perils of one government being in charge of the entire process. That would be the Democratic Party if he were to lose as the president of the United States.
Christie adds that Senator McCain has a place in history regardless of the outcome of the race.
Senator McCain's legacy will be one of an American hero. He is one who has served his country in uniform, one who has served his country in the United States House of Representatives, and most recently in the United States Senate. He has been a leader who has forged his ties across party lines to make meaningful change and enact meaningful policies on behalf of all the American people, regardless of whether they're a Republican or a Democrat. And I think his legacy will be one of a statesman, one who was willing to serve and sacrifice for his country.
That was political analyst Ron Christie, CEO of Christie Strategies. He also served as an advisor to President George W. Bush. This is News & Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. Early voters are turning out in record numbers to cast a ballot in this historic election. How will the presidential candidate's last-minute media blitz affect the polls on Tuesday? Our Reporters' Roundtable is going to take a look at these topics and more in a few minutes, but first we're going to look at the news affecting the media industry itself. This week, newspapers and magazines across the country were hit again with massive layoffs. The Christian Science Monitor announced this week that after a century, it would stop publishing a daily print paper. Joining us to talk about the cuts is Neil Henry. He's the dean of UC Berkeley's Graduate School of Journalism and the author of American Carnival, Journalism Under Siege in an Age of New Media. Welcome, Neil.
Thank you.
So I'm not exactly the newest babe on the media block. I have worked in print for Newsweek and, you know, on air for television, off air, blah, blah, blah. And it hurts me. I have to say, it really hurts me to hear about these incredibly steep cuts. You know, Time Incorporated saying 600 jobs, Gannett laying off people. I mean, the LA Times. Aside from the personal journalism pity party, what is this doing at a time like this election?
I gave a talk not long ago, actually, in Europe to a consortium of students at journalism schools in Denmark. A point I made was that one thing that the people in Europe might not understand is the severe contraction in the American news industry. An untold story of coverage of this particular campaign, that there are fewer and fewer organizations involved in actually covering it and fewer reporters due to the industry's contraction. And it's a hard thing to get outsiders to appreciate how important and significant a trend like this is, because we don't know the stories that aren't being covered.
Let's take a look at how information is moving from one medium to another. You have something like the Christian Science Monitor, and it's migrating to the web for most of its editions. What are the pros and cons of a move like that?
You save a lot of money because you don't put it out in hard copy as they have for many years. And another advantage is that you're trying to attract audiences who are gravitating to the web and digital media and by the millions. The question is whether people will actually go to a place like the Monitor for journalistic content. And this is the very struggle that every news organization that's attempting the transition is trying to make. You know, we talk about the personal repercussions of this. I was with the Washington Post for 17 years and came of age at a time when newsrooms are really opening to all kinds of different people, African Americans, Latinos, Asians. I came of age and my career there ended back in the early 90s, and I visited there just a few months ago. And I can't tell you how heartbreaking it was to see all of these people, sort of my generation, who were at the top of their game, struggling with the issue of buyouts because they had become too expensive. I mean, their talent is the best in the country, but they had to take buyouts in order for the corporation to survive. What happens to these people? Well, they use the money and maybe go into other fields like academia. Perhaps they go into public relations. Perhaps they start with blogging or other developments on the web. But what we've lost is very difficult to recoup. I mean, you're talking like a whole generation of training.
Let's talk about race. The LA Times, again, saw more editorial staff cuts, and John Mitchell, who's a Metro reporter, was one of those let go. He wrote this in his farewell email to his colleagues, and it was published on the website LA Observed. So he wrote, "As this phase of my life comes to a close, my good fortune is tempered by a troubling reality. I am the only African-American male on a Metro staff responsible for covering the most diverse city in the nation. There are no blacks in foreign," meaning the foreign desk, "and at a time when the nation may elect the first African-American president, there are none on the national staff." What does that say about where we are as not just an industry, but also many people consider journalism one of the organs of democracy?
Yeah, well, it's pretty ironic, isn't it, that we live in an age of dazzling communications possibilities and extraordinary ways to inform the public. Yet the people who I believe are responsible for providing the most important, meaningful, trustworthy, credible information are the ones that are losing their positions. It's also particularly ironic that this heartfelt statement was made by the reporter at the Times, because it was the Times back in 1965 that was played a role in the changes in the American newsrooms that had occurred after the riots in the inner cities in the late 60s. Back in 1965, when the Watts riots broke out, the reporters and editors at the Los Angeles Times tried to cover it, and they looked around the newsroom and they didn't see a single African American a reporter on staff. So they went down to the press room, found a guy named Bob Richardson, who was a printer, sent him out to Watts to cover it, and he phoned in reports from the scene. He was instrumental in the Times that year winning a Pulitzer Prize for its coverage. And it was after the Kerner Commission came out with its report in 1968, looking at the great divide among the races in American society, that pointed to the American news media in particular that needed to do a better job in covering the great diversity of American society.
What are the upsides? What are the upsides for journalism as it evolves? Because it has to evolve.
The upside are the incredible access you have to audiences now. Anybody in this age can be a publisher, a writer, a communicator. And there are tremendous possibilities.
Well, Neil, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Neil Henry is the dean of the UC Berkeley Graduate School of Journalism and the author of American Carnival, Journalism Under Siege in an Age of New Media. He joined us from the studios at the Journalism School. And now we're going to take a look at more of the week's news with Corey Dade, Atlanta correspondent for The Wall Street Journal, and Jerome Vaughn, the news program director for WDET in Detroit, Michigan. Hi, folks.
Hi there.
Hey, good to be with you.
So let's talk a little bit about infomercials, and I'm not talking about Ginsu knives. I'm talking about the presidency. The Nielsen television ratings show that more than 33.5 million people tuned in to watch Obama's 30-minute paid segment on Wednesday. Let's listen to a bit.
We've seen over the last 8 years how decisions by a president can have a profound effect on the course of history and on American lives. But much that's wrong in our country goes back even farther than that. We've been talking about the same problems for decades, and nothing is ever done to solve them. This election's a defining moment.
Jerome, how do you rate this, not on politics, but on production values?
It was
truly a beautiful thing. I mean, it was really hard to imagine in many ways that, you know, we're talking about this as an infomercial, but I mean, you know, in places the music swelled and the photography was gorgeous. And it was actually very interesting. It wasn't anything like, you know, back in the day you used to see infomercials for Flobies to, you know, cut your hair and things like that. It was quite engaging. And I think because of that, it really had an effect. I mean, that's why so many people watched it the other night.
It wasn't cheap either. We should say that from what we know, the infomercial ad buy, just the time alone, is estimated to have cost $5 million. And the commercial itself, producing it, cost somewhere between $3 and $5 million. Now, that's a small part of just the $150 million that the Obama campaign raised in September alone. But it's raising another question, Corey, which is public financing. Here's what Senator McCain said about Obama's huge coffers to CNN's Larry King.
That he signed a piece of paper back when he was a long shot candidate, and he signed it. Said, I will take public financing for the presidential campaign if John McCain will. I mean, that's a living document. He didn't tell the American people the truth.
Is this something that he, meaning Senator Obama, made a tactical or ethical violation about in terms of saying he was going to take public financing, but then realizing he may well be the best financer in the whole country in terms of raising political money and saying, actually, that's not really my plan?
Well, I think I obviously can't speak for him, but if along the lines of ethics, you know, did he lie? Well, I don't think anyone has really proven that he actually lied. He may have had every intention to take that money, take the public financing then. But as well we know, you know, any candidate has the prerogative to change their mind. I think the question is, would McCain be raising this if, in fact, the money was not helping Obama hold his lead over McCain? That's sort of the issue. And so at the end of the day, you know, McCain has a different in-game to asking the question. I think the thing to keep in mind is that, considering the kind of campaign that Obama has run, he actually needed this money for it. This is about the most expensive campaign you can imagine, because he had to come from so far behind. He had to literally build an infrastructure himself. If he had taken public financing, he wouldn't have been able to do that.
Corey, let me stay with you and talk about how voters are seeing their part in the process. Millions of people are actually going to the polls early, and you've been covering both Georgia and North Carolina. North Carolina is a traditional Republican stronghold, so how is that state playing out, both in terms of early voting and overall in the polls?
Well, I'm actually here right now for in North Carolina doing some reporting on the Senate race and the turnout so far. Just yesterday, the election board here in North Carolina decided to extend the voting hours of early voting on Saturday until 5 p.m. There are two specific heavily populated counties in Carolina who raised the request, and they acted on it. And the unique thing that North Carolina has going is sort of a one-stop shop where you can essentially register and vote on the same day. And that has brought voters out of the woodworks. And at this point, we're talking about, you know, a state that obviously wasn't in play before. But at this point, you know, we're talking about turnouts, you know, where you may have as many as, you know, at this point, perhaps 100,000 new voters who have turned out so far. And, you know, why? Well, obviously, you know, the competitiveness of the campaign in the state. But what's happened here in North Carolina also is that it has experienced sort of dramatic demographic changes since 1990, with sort of the economy down here changing into a more IT, high-tech job force that requires workers from other parts of the country coming here. And so what's happened in Virginia that has changed the dynamics there has also happened in North Carolina, with North Carolina a little bit further behind in that effort.
Mm-hmm.
And so the voting attitudes are changing, quite frankly, and becoming more moderate.
All right, Jerome, I want to take you in another direction, which is to take what Corey just said about this unprecedented flow of voters to the polls and put it in the context of people who are non-traditional voters, people who, you know, the people who are least likely to vote are people who are poorly educated and don't make a lot of money. And so there's been a lot of effort to get and also younger, to get these non-traditional voters to the polls. So earlier this month, we spoke to Def Jam Records founder Russell Simmons about the work he's doing to get out the vote. He's also working with GlobalGrind.com, and let's listen to what he had to say about the Countdown to Change initiative.
It's about getting young people engaged in the process. It's these hip-hop kids and what they want to see happen and how they not only perceive it but work towards it, and it's kind of a... It's an aggressive move to connect all of these movements to make that difference on November 4th.
Again, the group that he's running as a business, GlobalGrind.com, is running a Countdown to Change, and it's a social networking site that's aimed at younger urban Americans. Since youth could make a huge difference in this election, what's going to reach them? What do you think, Jerome? Is it online social networking? Is it door-to-door? What do you think is going to make a difference?
I think it's a matter of the combination of all of them. I mean, I know that's the easy out for the answer, but, you know, they're talking to each other face-to-face about these things. I work here, you know, on the edge of a college campus, and you see Obama T-shirts all over the place. You see stickers, bumper stickers, lawn signs, all the old form stuff. But, you know, people are texting each other. They're watching the infomercial. I mean, it is every form of media that people are getting involved in, and young people especially are getting involved in. And I want to say the other thing, you know, along that line is this is all about Obama. And that's not to say all of the young people are going to vote for him necessarily, but he's the one that's brought this change to the process that's energized people. You know, 4 years ago with, you know, President Bush and John Kerry, we didn't see all this energy in the youth. It's about Obama and what he brings to the table. And especially with the urban youth, that's why they're really excited about it.
Corey, does that make it hard to cover the campaign fairly? Because, for example, you can say, well, I want to cover equal sides of A and B. But if B is not much of a factor, if, for example, there are not as many youth-oriented organizations that are McCain-affiliated organizations, how does that complicate the job of the journalist?
Well, I think journalists are sort of, you know, predisposed to looking for balance. And I know, and I've just had this conversation with a Republican yesterday, that the media is biased toward more favorable coverage for Obama. And my response to him is that Obama has run, for all intents and purposes, a very media-centric campaign, which means that for a long time during the primaries, when he was ready to announce any big policy decision, when he was holding events, a lot of them were calibrated and scheduled and arranged in big markets where he could get TV coverage at certain times of the day when he wouldn't have to compete with other news broadcasts. And so as a result, he learned how to manipulate the media better. I think going forward, though, through the campaign, I think the challenge for journalists and news organizations is to, you know, counter with something else. And so in this case, you don't look to cover McCain's impact with young people per se. You look to cover McCain's impact wherever he's having the greatest impact. So in many cases, it's rural America. In many cases, it's more conservative communities, older citizens. And that's where you balance it out.
Jerome, quickly, what do you think folks in our business should be doing in the final couple days of this campaign?
Well, I think they should be getting some sleep this weekend if they can manage it. After that, I think, you know, really, I think a lot of us are going to be looking for, is there something that is unusual, that's out of the ordinary? I mean, both McCain and Obama, they're going to be giving their stump speech. They're going to be out there talking to as many people as they can. You know, is there going to be a new last-minute message? Is there going to be a new last-minute development? I think that's really what we're going to be looking for in the next couple of days.
All right, gentlemen, we will be all in this together. Thank you.
Thank you.
Speaking
to Jerome Vaughn, news program director for WDET in Detroit, Michigan. He joined us from their studios, plus Corey Dade, the Atlanta correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. Parents, teachers, and programs have tried a lot of different ways to boost Black girls' self-esteem, but what about doing it through rock and roll? Black Girls Rock is a mentoring organization founded by former model and current DJ Beverly Bond. She's one of the most successful female DJs on the scene. The group is holding its third annual awards this weekend in New York. We spoke briefly with the big winner, singer Erykah Badu, while she was out traveling with her family.
I love the interaction between myself and the audience. It always felt really good. And so when I got to be a big girl, continued to follow that dream and became a singer and eventually a recording artist. And when you become a recording artist, you're given a platform. That platform can be used for many, many things. And for some reason, and I'm still learning the reason, I choose to use my platform to uplift and ask questions and raise consciousness. And every time I use my platform, it's also therapy for me. So I grow a little bit every time.
In addition to honoring Badu, the group is also giving the Humanitarian Award to the model and entrepreneur Iman, who is also the global ambassador for the AIDS organization Keep a Child Alive. I sat down recently with Beverly Bond and asked her about the mission of her mentoring organization.
Black Girls Rock is a youth empowerment mentoring organization that I started for young women of color. I started it as a reaction to what I saw as very limited images of women of color in media.
So is this, when you use the word rock, you have a lot of fantastic musicians associated with this, and you yourself are no stranger to music. But mm-hmm. Do you mean rock as in rock music? Do you mean rock as in attitude? What are you talking about?
I mean, initially, of course, it meant rock as in attitude, but it does not exclude rock music. We're actually going to do a Black Girls Rock concert series right after the awards, and we are going to focus on alternative black artists.
Now, tell me about some of the women that you're going to be honoring and how you picked them.
The Black Girls Rock Awards, this is actually our third year of doing the awards. We launched with the first annual awards, and we started off with just two honorees. We honored DJ Jazzy Joyce, and we honored MC Light, and we honored both of them for being pioneers in hip-hop. So I started the Black Girls Rock mentoring program, but at the same time I said, you know what, not only do I need to start the mentoring program, we also need an award show. We need to also show young girls that there are these women out here who are doing major, beautiful, wonderful things and who are great role models that they don't get an opportunity to see all the time. And in year two, it just grew. We moved us to Lincoln Center. Last year we honored Susan Taylor for social humanitarian work. We honored Marsha Ambrosius from Flowetry. Common won our only one and only award that we give to men, which is the Soul Brother Number One Award. The Monument Award, which is what the Rutgers women's basketball team won last year, this year is being given to Nicole and Valerie Bell.
When you think about the work that you're doing, this is the most privileged country in the world, despite the fact that we're going through these very difficult times. And even when you talk about young girls of color, you're talking about, on a global scale, girls who are privileged. So why are girls having so much trouble finding their way in this society?
A lot of the girls in the hood are not privileged. And I think that also, if we are in such a privileged country, we're in such a diverse country, but yet the diversity is not shown in media. And this is a lot of the mind, the way that these young girls' minds are shaped is because of what they see and hear through media and music. And it's a misrepresentation. To me, it's obvious why there's problems for young girls of color. They're being shown one way, and they're being shown, like, you know, you can be, if you want to see yourself in a glamorized way, then you have to objectify yourself. That's the major message that's out for young women of color.
How'd you learn to DJ?
It's funny. I've loved music all my life. I've been attracted to music. I was a club kid. I would dance all the time. I knew mad DJs. I was collecting records, and you would have sworn I was a DJ when before I started DJing. I started in 2000, but you would have sworn I was a DJ before that, because if you saw my record collection, you'd be like, you know, people would come to my house and say, okay, who's the DJ? I'm like, oh, and I would always tell people I would never, ever do that, because I would never want that responsibility, because to me, being a DJ was a responsibility. And so I started practicing with my friends, and I already had the kind of the idea, because I knew many DJs before that. Before I got my turntable. So I kind of had the idea and the basics of what to do as a DJ, but honestly, I never really thought I was going to take it to the level that I took it to.
What's a track that you love that you think people should know about that they might not?
Oh, God, there's so many.
something that will get you up if you're feeling down.
Something that gets you up when you're feeling down. I think the live version of George Benson on Broadway. I think anything Stevie Wonder ever sings.
Yeah.
For me, Nas, the Illmatic album. Gosh, there's so many songs. I mean, Marvin Gaye, like anything he's ever made.
I noticed everybody you picked is a guy.
Yeah. Okay. Chaka Khan. I'm every woman. I know. I think that's the tomboy me. Let me wait a minute. There are plenty of women artists that I love as well.
Well, you have some great talent working with you on this event. And so, you know, Erykah Badu. And
oh, yeah. I should have said Erykah Badu.
Yep.
Mama's Gun. Listen to that album.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, if you could summarize kind of what you want girls to get out of what you're doing, just do it for me.
I just want girls to see that the world is not limited to them, and that they don't need to necessarily objectify themselves in order to get ahead. And I think that the message that they're getting right now is that that's the best way for them to get ahead. And I just want them to know that, like, you know, yeah, we're women, period. I think women are beautiful and sexy, and we have that. That's the icing. But you need the cake. And the cake is the substance and the skills and the intelligence and the rationale. It's like, that's what I think that they need to focus more on, because you have the other stuff. It's already there.
Well, Beverly, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
That was the founder of Black Girls Rock, DJ Beverly Bond. The organization will have its third annual award show this weekend in New York. And she joined us from our NPR studios in New York.
Welcome to a night of total terror.
Blackula. The Black Avenger.
Okay, sound effects have come a long way. We're talking about Blackula, Night of the Living Dead, Candyman, Bones. Black people in horror movies go way back. No, black folks are not always the first to die, thank you very much. For more on the world of black horror movies, we have with us Stephanie Dunn, an assistant professor of English at Morehouse College, and actor Tony Todd, who played the legendary horror icon, the Candyman. Happy Halloween, guys.
Happy Halloween, Farai. How are you?
I'm doing great.
Good afternoon, everybody. Hi, Stephanie.
Hi, Tony.
So, some people love them, some people hate them. I happen to love them. The crazed killers, scantily clad co-eds, people dripping ooze, any of that. Maybe it could also be the fact that horror movies break down social conventions, and horror films and black films do have a certain overlap zone. So, Stephanie, you've done some research on specifically blaxploitation films and cult cinema that overlaps the horror zone. What have you found out?
Well, for one thing, AIP, that's American International Pictures, put out a lot of the classic blaxploitation films. That's where we have Jack Hill's Coffee and Foxy Brown. But at first, they were doing a lot of horror films. For example, 1974 Vampira with Teresa Graves, who is later Get Christy Love. And they also put out Blackula in 1972. And so there are elements that we see in the blaxploitation films that borrowed nicely, if you will, or that parallel what we see in the horror films that American International Pictures invested in the early 1970s.
Tony, Candyman is not of the same genre. It's this film that unfolds in a certain very stratified, very specific, divided world of race and class. How would you describe what kind of a film Candyman is?
Well, I think it's a direct byproduct of urban mythology. The director, Bernard Rose, approached me because he had seen some work I had done in a project I did in Africa called The Last Elephant with James Earl Jones. And he says, you know, he played a Maasai warrior, and that's the kind of concept I have. And I wasn't really familiar with Clive Barker's work, but I read The Forbidden. Bernard had an interesting take of transposing it to Chicago. We went to do some research and things worked out, and before I knew it, we had Philip Glass along and, you know, Virginia Madsen, Vanessa Williams, Casey Lemons, and we had a great cast and a great time in the citizens of Chicago. So to this day, 16 years later, not a minute goes by where somebody that doesn't acknowledge that moment of cinema. And I think it was a triumph, you know, in some social, we talked about conventions breaking down. This guy actually survived for 99% of the movie. You know?
Yeah.
And it was an anti-hero.
It was
a love story originally intended. You know, the studio got a little nervous at the last minute and cut some key scenes. But what remains is still that attraction that's between the two characters and what one will do for the other in terms of undying love and so forth.
Well, we have a little bit of the original Night of the Living Dead and also of Candyman.
Dwayne Jones.
I'm hoping we can take a listen to Candyman.
We have a bargain.
But I'm afraid.
Do you fear the pain or what is beyond?
Both.
The pain, I can assure you, will be exquisite.
So tell me about the love story aspect of Candyman.
Well, we had, when Bernard gave me the script, we did some Renaissance body work, Virginia and I. We had 6 months to do horseback riding and fencing, all the elegant Phantom of the Opera type thing. And if you know the backstory of Candyman, he was a painter in turn of the century, and he fell in love with, quote-unquote, the wrong person, and then he was lynched and castrated and had his arm cut off. So it's the ghoul of the spirit of this person who was an artist whose father was a shoe cobbler who just wanted to be in love that, you know, is forced to follow this person through eternity. So,
Stephanie, that's, you know, it's very interesting because you've got a lot of history and rebellion tied up in that narrative. Are horror movies generally about rebellion, or are they more about just, you know, kind of making the adrenal gland and you know, all your adrenaline pump?
I think that it's a combination. They're definitely about the former. But Stephen King wrote this great essay that is called something like Why We Crave Horror, you know, Films. And he suggests that this feeds something in us. We get some distance, right, from the horror because we're not in it, so to speak, right? But it feeds our sort of natural inclination to be thrilled by and excited by, you know, the horrific, if you will. So we have this sort of investment. We get to have this sort of spectator pleasure, right, in all of this, you know, surreal, sort of scary blood. And it's almost sort of like an outlet, I think. But there are also some subversive, I think, elements to horror films. There's the rebellion. That's why you have a lot of horror films sort of revolving around, right, aliens and, right, people who are, you know, the living dead sort of type of people. And we have this mix there.
Let me jump in and play a little bit from Night of the Living Dead. That was back from 1968 and one of the first horror films, big horror films, to have a black man as the protagonist. Here's the hero Ben and another survivor hiding in a house surrounded by flesh-eating zombies.
Help me! Please! Don't you know what's going on out there? This is no Sunday school picnic.
Don't you understand? My brother is alone!
Your brother is dead.
No!
What about the racial elements of a scene like that?
Do you know what? What's interesting about that film is that it's the way it consciously does not really acknowledge race in the sense of Ben and his relationship with the other characters. So, for example, there's the white man, older white man, Mr. Cooper, who Ben is at odds with throughout the film. So all through this film, Ben gets to, you know, curse him out, tell him, you know, you can be the boss downstairs, I'll be the boss upstairs. And he basically gets to be in control in terms of determining the moves that the other survivors and he make. But it's at really, I think, at the end of the film that you get a little bit of a hint as to some of the possible racial implications because of what happens to Ben and why it happens to him, precisely how he's killed.
Tony, you do so many different types of acting in addition to doing stage work. You're also in 24, entering its seventh season. Yeah. And also you've got something...
which we had to go to Africa to shoot, by the way.
I'm excited about that. Yeah. Also on BET with something called Night Tales. Tell us just quickly about that.
Well, Night Tales debuts tonight as a film I made with this black filmmaker in Sacramento called Dion Taylor. And it's a very interesting thing. BET picked it up and they're broadcasting it like four times tonight.
All right.
So Flavor Flav is the host.
I'm scared right now.
But I think they contained him. He was there.
If nothing else, that'll get me scared. Yeah. Tony and Stephanie, happy Halloween again.
Happy Halloween,
everybody. Happy Halloween, Farai. Happy Halloween, Tony.
Thank you.
We've been speaking to actor Tony Todd, who played the legendary horror icon Candyman. He joined us from NPR West. And Stephanie Dunn, assistant professor of English at Morehouse College.